Well, you can hang out for a little while, though, right?
Yeah, for like a little while. Sure.
This is the Extra Hot Gray Podcast, episode 339 for the week of January 25th, 2021. I am short grass in need of mowing, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Turnpiker Sarah D. Bunting.
It's my way and the highway.
Easy Pass Tara Ariano.
What did you call me?
And Lost McMullen brother Dan Rogie.
It's pronounced Massapequa.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Grape. Before we get into it, a couple pieces of site business up top. One, if me and Tara sound different this week, is because we had to revert to an old inferior setup because the neighbors behind us decided today is shingle replacement day. So we're trying to hide from all that noise. And a reminder for our Patreon people that this is the month in which we switch from charging at the end of the month to charging at the start of the month. So as you probably heard on our last Patreon episode, you will be charged for January at the end of January and then February at the beginning of February. So two charges will come sort of on the heels of each other, but you're not being double charged. We're just switching we're switching our time of the month is what I'm saying. So with that, let's syncing get up into it. We welcome back Mr. Dan Rogie. Hello, Dan.
Hello.
Yay!
Today's topic is Bridge and Tunnel, and I will do a quick synopsis for you. Bridge and Tunnel is an Edward Byrne show about three college-age boys and three college-age girls who return to their Long Island homes and try to have sex with their old high school flings. Edward Burns directs the show with the same dynamic energy as his brother Ken brings to his baseball and Civil War documentary series.
Dun, 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 dun. Well, I would add it's on Epix, which is a premium cable channel. Yes, it is. Look it up. I had a couple of more recent credits for Edward Burns for the people that only remember him from the 90s, as Dan name checked in his intro from the Brothers McMullen. He has done things in this millennium, like that TNT show Public Morals that was on for a hot second that was executive produced by Steven Spielberg. And he also did an episode of Amazing Stories. So I guess they're still buddies. And it's set in 1980. But other than that, everything else Dave said is is like totally on point. Specifically, the issue of the fucking is, you know, will the fucking distract from everyone's big plans for what they're going to do after graduation?
You remember when Ross and Rachel, will they, won't they? How about we do three of those at the same time? Hey.
Well, and will our leads, Jimmy and Jill, fulfill their ambitions of becoming a National Geographic photographer and a fashion designer, respectively, or succumb to their destiny of starring in a Billy Joel song like Jimmy and Jill? As soon as I said their names, you all inserted them into Moving Out. You know it. Also, Edward Burns is in it as the main guy's dad. It gives me no pleasure to report. He can still get it. I'm sorry. So, Jen, check in.
I'm sorry, too.
Let's start with Dan. Dan, should our listeners watch this show?
Speaking to his more recent credits, An Amazing Story, this isn't. But I will say what I do appreciate is that if you, like so many of us, went into an Ed Burns directorial coma following the Brothers McMullen, made in 1995. It was nice to wake up from that coma and discover that he had not evolved as a director at all. It is a fixed point in a chaotic world, and I have to say I appreciate that.
Well said. Sarah?
Absolutely not. It's bad.
Dave?
No.
Yeah, it's very inessential. I would say that. Yep. You can skip
when that's the gentlest thing said about it. I mean, really.
I mean, I can't even, like, it's so blah that you can't even, like, get that exercised about saying how that it's bad, really. Like, it's so forgettable.
It's flat, but also, like, none of the characters hit. Like, they're either not likable enough or not unlikable enough. Like, everything is just oatmeal in this show, and it's sort of impressive. Yep. How many things are exactly in the middle of the likability scale? Yeah. Like, as a whole, is sort of an achievement, but not a great one, much like the show itself.
Right. So, Dan, you are famously from Long Island. Was Bridge and Tunnel authentic enough to make you homesick or phony enough to irritate you?
Well, listen, why can't it be both? You know, listen, I watched the first three episodes and then Tara style, I stopped in the middle of the fourth and I didn't even so much stop as just drift off from watching. It was like 1 second I was watching it and the lines were so blurred between watching this and not watching this that it just sort of drifted. Why did a thing happen? Even one? So to answer your question, I guess from a branding our setting POV, like maybe I'm extra burned out, even by Wonder Woman, stick with me, a filmed property that at least used its 80s-ness to the least advantage of any filmed property that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
So to continue with this one, like just to start, don't set something on Long Island and then throw the first musical track to Steve Miller, resident of the iconic Long Island town of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I often say that after a childhood on Long Island, when I sit in a quiet room, the sound I hear in my head is not silence, but rather the sound of old Jews complaining. And like the second sound I hear is Billy Joel's newest release, Glass Houses, playing in all of the bars.
And yeah,
I did not hear that.
Yeah.
No.
Although I will say one more thing just sort of about the setting is that like the sensation of watching the show on a very general basis, like inauthentic as some of those small touches are, there is something to being to feeling trapped on Long Island in the 80s, right? This is a feeling I know a lot about. I was on Long Island in 1980. I was closer to zygote age. Just kidding. You guys know how old I am. We were probably all hanging out in Vegas that weekend. But from like a set deck perspective, like this is what the houses looked like. This is what the furniture looked like. Yeah. The clothes, the hair, the bedspreads. Like functionally, it is the street I grew up on. And when I said I would say something nice, I didn't expect that it would be meet Ed Burns, master of mise-en-scène, but like astroturfy as some of it is, yes, it is lived experience in that way.
Sarah, you grew up very nearby in New Jersey. What were your feelings about this this experience?
I'd agree with Dave that like it is almost impressive that along every possible axis, it's a C-. Like the sort of pointedness of the fucking scenes, the look at our music budget when we didn't bother really hiring an accent coach. This is where it sort of lost me as a, you know, as the tunnel, half of the Bridge and Tunnel reps here. The character, Jill's character, went to FIT, allegedly. And then there's like a whole runner about her accent. And that's when I was like, I can't even enjoy like hate watching it or watching it to make fun of anymore, because there's just no understanding that like after 4 years at FIT, the accent would be gone.
Right. Mm.
Also, she would dress better. Like, sorry, but like what a Jane Mancini way to treat this character who's supposed to be the next great fashion designer.
Right.
Except also she's kind of like irrational and not likable. There's just so many like failures here and like lacks of handhold. I mean, but yeah, as a Jerseyan, like I couldn't really speak to the authenticity of 1980s Long Island, but it is functionally the same thing, except it's, you know, a state and not surrounded by water. But I just felt like this didn't know whether it was apologizing for these people or heroizing these people, and it did neither. And as a result, I don't care. It's very static and dull, and the music is great, but that's not enough.
When I first read about this and saw it was set in 1980, I was like, okay, well, at least this isn't exactly the same thing he always does. Like, this is definitely not about himself, because, you know, he was obviously much younger than this at that time. But then when you watch it, it's like, well, I don't know why this is set in 1980 then, because it doesn't seem like, I don't know what it is saying about these people or that time. Like, it just seems like this is an excuse to A, prove to people he can do something else.
Right.
And B, like, have people fuck without a condom and not worry about getting AIDS. Like, I truly do not know what other reason there is for it. And in terms of the fucking, I know we keep coming back to it, but there is so much of it. And like the cold open of the pilot is the two, is Jimmy and Jill having sex in the bathroom at the bar.
Yeah.
And it's just so expected.
Whoa. Adding some Joel accents for
I mean, also that is the largest and cleanest bar bathroom I ever saw. So maybe I should move to Long Island because that's not how people were rocking it in Brooklyn. Not that it matters because he can't go to bars. And that's the other thing, like these just like depopulated scenes, like that tavern would be packed.
Totally. Yeah. Right.
It's summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And can we not have phrases like a huge ask in a property that's supposed to take place in 1980? Like mm-hmm. I was keeping a running list of anachronistic phrasings. And then I was like, that's right. This is the only thing I care about this. I'm going to stop. It just... I think it really is trying to do something, but I don't know what, and I'm not going to find out what. Yeah.
I think the least authentic part of it, too, is story-based, such as it is, because initially, I think my inclination was to say that the story itself is so thin that they forgot to include one, which is true, but I think that it's actually worse than that, because as much as the scenes are kind of slow and these kind of small-ball non-stories are getting dragged out for no reason... The inciting incident stakes of the show are the fakest of all, i.e. the main dude leaving Long Island because he is a nature photographer who is relocating to Alaska for a job at National Geographic. Like, no, dude, you most certainly are not. Like, if you're playing into the provincialism of this being like the niche place with no mobility that you need a bridge or tunnel just to get out of, like, okay, so... New York provincialism is real in itself. I have a friend who grew up in Bensonhurst in South Brooklyn, and her mother cried and said, I'll never see you again now that you're moving to the city, when my friend moved to a slightly different part of Brooklyn. And those are the stakes that would be more believable to me in a part of the country where Westchester is considered upstate. Like in 1980s Long Island, you were an explorer if you went shopping at a different mall, and no one is going to Alaska. Like, no one.
Yeah, no, that's Jersey. Totally the same.
Aww.
I don't exactly know how to put this, but like when you were talking about the sort of story-based stakes, I wonder if anyone else drew this parallel. Actually, I don't, and I hope you didn't, but I feel like Ed Burns has no experiential understanding of what it's like to be a, quote, real Long Island 22-year-old mm-hmm. because he did the Ed Burns thing, and it was sort of like watching Girls after a while and being like, what? The fuck do you know about struggling in Bushwick? You have not had these struggles. You have not worked in a coffee shop. Like, all of this is as told to. And I wonder if that's not part of the problem, is that there is this like estrangement from this actual story because he didn't live it. Like, not that people can't write what they didn't live, but Ed Burns can't, and he can't direct it either. Sorry, kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like his direction boils down to like everyone has to yell all the time. It's a lot of yelling.
Yeah. I feel like the cast is also trying to compensate for coming at it from so many different perspectives and accents. And like, also, I'm sorry to say, like, I'm gorgeous, but we have to talk about the attractiveness as relative to the Long Islandiness of the roles that they are playing. Like, sorry, Long Island.
Speak
has
on
like,
that.
Long Island has a very deep working class streak to it. Like, Hicksville is a real town on Long Island with real people, and no one bothers to laugh when they say the name of the town. And these like waxed underwear models are generally not consistent with my recollection of post-collegiate life in Hewlett or wherever they are. And like, the accents, I know you alluded to it already, but that range from like SNL sketch about the Buttafuoco's all the way through to I think this guy is literally Australian just like makes it so difficult to orient yourself anywhere within like the real.
Yeah, a couple of them are Australian. The Jill is too. Yeah, for real.
Well, yeah, but there were definitely a few moments where, like, if you're ever listening to a show with actual New Orleans people set in New Orleans and you're like, why does it sound like Brooklyn got dipped in Tabasco sauce? Like, there were a couple of moments like that with these accents that I was like, like on top of everything else, like the ethnography of the accent is wrong. And then the actual accent is wrong. Like, guys,
yep.
What? Why are we here?
Well, we can stop. This is a bad show and people shouldn't watch it.
No, they
cool.
should not.
Next.
It is time to go around the dial. First stop, Tara.
Back with my high low, starting with my high. This a show called Perfect Life. I won't try to say it in Spanish, although it is from Spain. I don't know if it's in fact an award-winning dramedy import from Spain, which dropped on HBO Max last Thursday. Leticia Dolera created it and also stars as Maria, who is about to sign the mortgage on an apartment with Gustavo, her fiancé, when the notary hands her a black pen. And since she doesn't want her signature to be in the same color as the text of the contract, for whatever reason, she asks if anyone else has a different colored pen, and the mortgage broker does, so it's fine. But Gustavo loses it and says Maria's too rigid and nothing's ever good enough for her. And they have a fight about an incident 3 months ago where she made him give her an enema before she would have anal sex with him. And they have not had sex since, apparently. And so he can't enter into a mortgage with her and leaves, which also means they lose the down payment, by the way. So Maria goes to see her sister, Esther. Seems like they're going to move in, or she's going to move in with Esther, at least temporarily. And she decides to change her life, starting immediately, by badly cutting her hair with kitchen scissors and taking Molly before going to their friend Christina's daughter's birthday party. Christina, by the way, has her own problems. Her husband really wants to have another child. They have either two or three already. I couldn't tell. They're rich enough to have multiple full-time groundskeepers, but she is taking birth control in secret so that she doesn't get pregnant again. So Maria is rolling so hard at the party that she wanders into the bouncy castle where she has an encounter with Gari, one of the groundskeepers, and it's established earlier that he has a learning delay of some kind. Christina gives him cash to pay the delivery guy for the birthday cake, and he takes a while to count out the change very, very carefully. Plus, when he runs into Maria, he is also drunk because his boss has given him shots to celebrate the boss's retirement. So this is not a great situation on either side, like consent-wise, but we just see them kiss and then their feet disappear inside the bounce house. And I was like, well, the rest of this is kind of interesting in this Sex and the City way. Maybe Maria and Gari just kissed. And then at the end of the episode, it's 7 weeks later, the Chiron, and Maria's in a doctor's office getting an ultrasound and being told she's 7 weeks pregnant. So she did have sex with an intellectually disabled person who was maybe too intoxicated to consent. And my feeling about that reveal was yuck. So I think I'm done with Perfect Life personally.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Then, my low, we watched the first episode of Walker.
Oh, okay.
The reboot of Walker, Texas Ranger on the CW, because apparently I am determined to at least sample every procedural that is set in Austin. The creator is Anna Frick or Fricky. She started on shows like Everwood, which we're about to talk about, and Men in Trees, but whose latest credit was the swiftly canceled CW military show Valor from a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. She's given interviews in the run-up to the premiere of Walker about how they adjusted the show to respond to concerns about law enforcement after the protests of last summer, which, like, that's already a problem if you didn't adjust your thinking in response to the many protests to police brutality that have been happening, you know, for 7 years. But anyway, the fact that woke prosthetics have been attached to this show's skeleton is very obvious when you watch it. Examples. The first thing that happens is Mrs. Walker is killed in the course of doing her job, which is supplying water at way stations that migrants from Mexico use. Walker's new partner is a Mexican-American woman who is not in good standing with her family because they're not okay with her working in law enforcement due to the inequities inherent in the system. Although that is sort of treated like, oh, my crazy family, they're annoying. And when this woman gets back from her first day, her boyfriend, who is black and who is a medic in the military, comments on her uniform belt buckle, and she says it's made by convict labor. And he says, that's messed up. And she's like, yep. And then he's like, well, let's get it off you and let's fuck, basically. Right? Dave, you watched it. Is that not what happened?
God, that show has like left my mind so quickly. Okay. It was so nothing.
There's also a plot line regarding a friend of Walker's daughters whose parents are undocumented, but that was like really telegraphed and expected. But overall, God. It's another one that's not worth getting mad at because it's so cheap and dumb and boring. When we started the episode, we both were like, why is this even on the CW? It's like clearly CBS show in spirit, like, which is where the original was. It's where all the other procedural remakes are. Like,
it's how they they'll move it there, but it's how they get the supernatural people. And then how's his hair?
Oh, hold on. I'm getting to it.
Oh, no.
Yeah. That's the one thing I do remember about this episode.
Oh, no.
I have a whole paragraph. Hold on. So, yeah, as it went on, it didn't even look like a CBS show. Like, it's so corny and it looks so cheap. It's like a syndicated action show. But the very cheapest thing is whatever is happening with Jared Padalecki's hair.
No,
we talked about this briefly when we watched the Supernatural finale because there was a promo that showed his new haircut. But it's incredibly weird. Whatever they're doing in the front, like the back is also bad. It's like long for no reason. And it like kind of curls up because he has a cowboy hat on all the time. Like maybe the reason it's so long is that that's the only place he can grow it. And he's proud of that because his hairline in the front is completely bizarre. It's not the same color as the rest of it. Like the literal line of it does not make sense when you look at it. Like it doesn't blend with whatever remains on top. Like my best guess it's the best bad weave that the CW could afford. I'm not telling you to watch the whole episode. Don't. But turn it on. You can watch it on the CW app or the website for free. Scrub forward to the first scene where he has no hat on in daylight and pause and like just try to understand what is happening. It's very perplexing. That's my review.
Only you can help solve a mystery.
His hair, I called it law enforcement Dracula.
It is.
He has like a Bela Lugosi thing happening, but it doesn't go as far back as it should when you have it. It's very like, do you remember those memes from like 5-6 years ago of Nicolas Cage with a bird as hair?
Yes.
And the beak is sort of like over the top of his head. It's sort of approaching that territory, but then like it's way too dark. It's way too defined. And
but it's also like square on top. It's like a rectangle.
Yeah. There's like too many mixed signals. Like here's the Widow Peak starting, but this hair is twice as thick as it should be. Like it is the one memorable thing about this show. It was his hair.
It's bad. Anyway, for my plug. I wrote about my summer of and fall of collecting the entire run of Sassy Magazine for the New York Times Magazine. And it ran in Sunday's issue. And we will link that in the show notes. Listen to Sassy, the podcast that Dave and I are doing with Pamela Ribbon, has dropped its first teaser episode. Please subscribe to that. Follow us on all the socials. And our first proper episode is dropping next Tuesday, February 2nd.
Dan Brogy.
Well, I wanted to talk about Cobra Kai season 3, my low-key favorite show ever, the 80s action movie that never stops giving, like even young Kreese in Vietnam is hot. They didn't have to be that thoughtful in their casting. Or I wanted to talk about how I finally watched Haunting of Hill House and now I can't use the bathroom by myself without checking in the mirror for the broke neck lady. Like, how have you guys all slept since 2018? But instead, I am here today to swing myself around the dial and past the bookshelf to talk about a print spinoff of America's Next Top Model, namely the novel, that's right, the fiction novel entitled The Wig, The Bitch, and The Meltdown, written, and I say this with Tyra's ego-sized air quotes, written by Tyra's sprightly platinum sidekick, J. Manuel. Now, Tara heroically sent me a copy of this book back in Time is Meaningless Timber, I think with the expectation that I would one day actually finish it and send it back to you, since which time I have read the first 200 and final 10 pages. Like, don't make this book 300 pages long, Mr. J. And to see that my fingers are covered in sour grapes from this thinly veiled tell-all swipe about his time under the thumb of declining supermodel Shmyra Schmanx, remember, this is fiction, when she hosts and executive produces a modeling competition reality show and threatens to take down both him and it with her diva behavior at every turn. So, Tara, I believe Like I said, I promised I would send it back to you, but not having left the house in 300 days, I'm literally like, how do you mail stuff? So instead, here is a chosen at random excerpt to illustrate what I am depriving you of from page 8. Backstage, the champagne flowed like kisses, and everyone congratulated each other and themselves for being fabulous, as well as putting on a fabulous show. No one seemed to recall that it was Pablo who'd rescued the show from disaster and made it fabulous.
Wow. Yeah.
So,
sorry, I have a question about that. In what circumstance or situation do kisses flow?
Flow.
Yeah, the kisses, yeah. They flow. J. Emanuel says that the kisses are flowing, and that in and of itself is
like champagne.
Is fabulous. Yes, just like champagne. The kisses. pour them out. Pour out a big glass of kisses for the writing career of one J. Emanuel. So I did write extensively in the margins, and here is a sample of my other immediate extemporaneous reactions to things that I was seeing.
Thank God.
Unless this is a period piece set in 2003, this is all very unlikely. All this insider tea. Who else was going to spend 3 pages explaining what the fourth wall was? No, J. Emanuel, you did not create the logo for America's Next Top Model. This character is becoming the Are We the Baddies meme come to real life. And then finally, the one juicy tidbit that I wanted to share for free is that according to Shmaish Manuel, or whatever the character's name is, when Shmyra is feeling sorry for herself after having a diva attack and marches off of set, she retreats to a private table at Virgil's, which is a mid-priced barbecue restaurant in the middle of Times Square. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the Venn diagram of people who understand America's Next Top Model and Virgil's barbecue intersects squarely around my name. And so if that is the one tidbit that I have learned from this, and that is in fact true, it made the entire reading experience worthwhile, except it didn't. It's horrible. So yeah, the book is terrible. But more than that, it is very petty. Like, he spends pages upon pages talking about, like, contract negotiations and his exclusivity clauses that he had for working on other projects. And I was like, you were so inside baseball. Like, he went on like a refinery, he was doing like a very like low-key junket for it, for like the three people who actually want to talk to him about it. And it just came across sounding so sad. Like, oh, it was, man. Like, the fact that he decided to litigate this now was like, oof, thank you for showing up with the latest and greatest. So the book is terrible. And more than that, it is very petty. And Tara, I'm very sorry that I stole it from you. And I promise to get it back in your hot little hands one day.
Well, send it to the next person in the chain, because I still want to have a book club about it and like talk about it for a Patreon episode. It feels important that like you and I and Sarah and Will Ellis should have like a summit discussing yes. this like in detail.
It is on the way. Send me the address.
I will send UPS to your house.
Done. And so you shall have it, as I am incapable of doing anything but being a head in a jar. Cool.
Is there anything you would like to plug?
For my plug, I actually would like to plug someone else, if I may, and amplify a piece of writing that I recently read and loved, and will allow me to actually take one more spin around the dial to an actual TV show that I am watching, which is I am finally watching The Leftovers, a show that I had weirdly never seen. It was a total gap in my HBO, many different iterations of their glory days. And I will be honest, I was struggling through a very dark season one. And I had wondered initially if I had made a huge mistake embarking on a show about 2% of the world's population disappearing. I mean, what? Mm-hmm. But I came across a piece by Emily Vanderwerf that she wrote for Vox. And she not only kind of contextualizes this very grim first season within the run of the series, but then also explains why it is actually the perfect companion piece for 2021. And that there's some real empathy in the characters to come, even if it's kind of hard to see from the beginning. And I don't know. I have since finished season one. I've moved on to season two, and it really sort of helped as like a piece of TV criticism that helped like sort of build up why I now love the show so much. So I am loving the show and loving the piece. So if you haven't read it, you should.
Excellent. We will link it in the show notes. Thank you, Dan.
Sarah D. Bunting.
So I would like to thank Gwen Schweitzer, our listener, who pointed out to us that Emily's Bangs of Sadness from Everwood Amy's Bangs of Sadness, as they were then known, are back on HBO Max. HBO Max has the entire series run, if Everwood, all four seasons, like an iron filing to a magnet. I went to HBO Max and started watching it. There were things. I watched the whole series, but I sort of, like, it ended. I went about my life. So there were things that I had forgotten, but I had not forgotten the show's ability to really yank a nose hair and make you cry, like, just every single week. And I'm watching the pilot and just sort of marveling at, like, it's really fascinating to watch it and just be like, this is really quite sentimental and corny, sort of not in the more recent sense of that word, but like just mm-hmm. old school Seventh Heaven style corn. But it really gets over. I'm not exactly sure how they do that. A lot of it is the acting, which is very good. A lot of it is that they give the younger sister some storylines, but like just enough to give you a break mm-hmm. From how sweet and sad and frustrating everyone else is. People are allowed to be bratty. Treat Williams is extremely charming. I don't think I thought he was hot in the initial run, but now I'm kind of feeling Treat and his beard. And then like Chris Pratt shows up and you're like, oh yeah, like he's just the prattiest. Like the first time he shows up on screen, he's literally making a derp face as Bright Abbott. And you're like, oh, hey buddy, like this is the Chris Pratt that we enjoy. So yeah, I'm like continuing to watch it. It like for long stretches of a given episode, you don't actually have to be paying that close of attention. And then you find yourself like becalmed in it. And then there's like the big showdown scene at minute 37. And you're like, I think that if you're looking for something that is cathartic, like if you feel like you need some happy cleansing tears, I would recommend this. And I definitely thank you, Gwen, for pointing this out, that nice. This was available. It's been a pleasure to return to it, not least to visit all the fashions from, ladies and gentlemen, 2002. Oh my God. Like, I think I forgot that the show actually was that old, but oh man, like so many V-neck tops over tissue camis, so mm-hmm. many jeans with like a 6-inch rise and bell bottoms. The Bangs of Sadness have not appeared yet, but soon. Yeah, this was a really good show that I think was underrated. And I think it's probably a little strange to people that this was like the dawn of Damn You, Berlanti. But man, so if anyone else is rewatching, hit me on Twitter at Tomato Nation. I would love to hear from you. For my plug, things that have aged less well. Dennis Quaid's career, Quaid in Full, returns for season four. As you're listening to this tomorrow, season four is the early to mid 90s. We have some excellent guests coming up, including Ms. Tara Ariano.
Hello.
But first, we have to get through Come See the Paradise in episode one. But once again, that's me and Jeb Lund watching every single thing Dennis Quaid ever filmed. In chronological order, we have many, many Quaids to go before we sleep, but we hope you'll join us. That's Quaid in Full Pod on Twitter and Quaid in Full wherever you get podcasts.
911, Lone Star is back. 911, Lone Star is back. Guys, 911, Lone Star is back. TV's craziest bonkers regular network show has returned. The show you may remember from past episodes being discussed here, Exploding Bull Semen, things like that. are an every episode event. I haven't seen one episode of the original one, and frankly, I'm scared to, because I don't know if it's going to, you know, satisfy me in the way exploding bull semen canisters can.
Find a nickel.
So this season, they, first of all, they just, Liv Tyler's disappeared and she's gone, and Odina Torres has replaced her, which upgrade.
Speaking of the leftovers.
The weird thing, though, is the opening premiere episode was really dull for a 911 Lone Star episode. Like, not a lot of crazy stuff happened. But then they really made up for it in the second episode, where in Austin, a volcano erupts.
Yeah.
And among the ways it terrifies and stalks people is, it drives scorpions towards somebody cleaning their food truck after the night. So we have lava and scorpions approaching this food truck.
Oh, wow.
And she can't get out. A frat party, some sort of fancy hotel-esque situation. The lava bubbles up from under and turns all the pools into death trap boiling pots, basically. Mm-hmm. And features a person who, you know, you're supposed to not care they die because they're a real jerk, get degloved as somebody tries to pull them out of the nature's hot tub.
It's in the cold open.
Yeah.
That scenario also features not one, but two people getting lava bombs in the chest. And so, like, the race against time for the first one was, the lava bomb is actually, like, sinking into his body and will cook his heart if we don't get it out. And they're, like, scrambling with clamps and trying to get it out, but the clamps are just melting because it's lava. And then a medic gets, like, slammed with an even bigger lava bomb. All this is happening in one episode. And that's not even all. The best poetic lava incident is a family doing mini putt, and they're at the devil's mouth hole, and the devil's mouth opens up, and it is literally hell underneath. And the father falls. First, he tries to grab onto the horns to keep from falling into the pit, but then he does fall into the pit. Our heroes are called to the scene, and his body is half melted into the devil's head inside of the pit, and they try to hoist him up. And his skin is like silly putty or taffy in between his face. Like, I don't think skin would melt or stretch like that in the real world. But boy, I tell you, it was a real bazooka gum great moment for television, because, boy. And then we're not even done with it. So, like, all the volcano stuff ends. And then, like, the coda to the episode is, there is this kid, like, you know, 20 miles out of town or something like that. And like the super volcano is now happening or something. And now it's like, they got to call in the original 911 squad and
cross them out
next week.
Wow.
Guys, 911 is the perfect show for casual viewing, because it engages you with its bonkerness. And when that happens, you want to pay attention, but it gives you full permission to go on your phone when they're talking about things like Rob Lowe's cancer, or, you know, the new medic captain balance work? Nobody cares, right? Those are all 7-minute interludes
lava
between five different crazy bonker shit things that happen each episode. It's the perfect show to give yourself permission not to pay attention to, but enjoy. And I really appreciate that in 2021.
I love it. It's such a good show. It's super dumb. But if anyone follows us on, you know, Twitter and Instagram, or me, I guess Dave isn't on those anymore. We like a good, extremely stupid action movie, but there's only so many of those. I mean, did we watch Money Train this weekend? Yes. Was it enjoyable? Sure. Eventually we're going to run out of Jean-Claude Van Damme movies, maybe. And then we will probably start watching 911 Prime, because there's like 3 seasons of that to go through. I think they're in season 4 now. Because we sampled the first episode and it didn't really take, but then it continued to get crazier, clearly. So, you know, in the off season for Lone Star, that will be a balm, and possibly will have many bombs also.
It really reads like a dream rejected list from these type of shows of yesteryear. Like, you know, ER approached it once in a while. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was just going to bring up the vengeful helicopter.
Right. It's like vengeful helicopter every fucking week.
Like four times an episode. This. Like it's not truly not since Hannibal have I watched a show and been like, I don't know how this is allowed on network television. But it is.
But it is. And guys. That's what I like about Texas. This week on the Great American Pop Culture so Quiz Show, it is the playoff match between Tim Grierson, Linda Holmes, and Chris Sims. It was a good episode. Nice. Next week is our last playoff match before the championship, and that will feature old school TWAP recapper and current Slate writer and editor, Dan Coyce. We also have past and future EHG guest at Defectors, Dave Roth, also one half of Dave and Jeb Armin, who we've all been a guest on. And our third contestant is Appointment Television's Margaret H. Willison. And really encourage you to listen to this episode because some crazy stuff happens. All right. And then on the next extra hot grate, we have complete that EOT and we figure out how to get one of the 12 living actors who have Tonys and Oscars, but not Emmys. We're going to figure out how to get them their Emmy. That is available to supporters of any level at patreon.com/extrahotgrate. Thank you so much for all our supporters. And then on the next EHG Prime, we welcome LaToya Ferguson on the show to discuss the Netflix adaptation of Firefly Lane, which according to the publisher's description on Amazon is, and I quote, "For anyone who ever drank Boone's Farm apple wine while listening to ABBA or Fleetwood Mac. So get ready, get set. Let's go next week. It's Firefly Lane."
Today's extra credit topic is called Commander on Screen. Comes to us from Andrew Potsy Potts. I had to edit his setup slightly because it's been sitting in the hopper since before the election. So here we go. With a U.S. presidential election behind us, it's time to start looking ahead at candidates for 2024. Which TV politicians would we like to see on the ticket? Unlike reality, they don't have to be born in America. So Borgen's PM Birgitta Nyborg is fine. From this planet, Chancellor Palpatine, or even alive, Joffrey Lannister? And Potsy suggests, why settle for the lesser evil, Palpatine Vader 2020? Why don't we start with our guest, Dan Rogge, who is your presidential ticket for 2024, TV character edition?
In a time when political scandal disappears so fast down the memory hole you can't remember what happened yesterday, who is more prime for a political comeback than the UK Prime Minister from episode one of Black Mirror, the national anthem?
He was on my short list.
Nice. Great minds and also ours.
He's mm-hmm. back, baby.
Love it.
So even by the standards of that episode, where if I remember the ending, I think things actually worked out kind of well for him. Mm-hmm. And on the, you know, and in current day America, on one side, a politician who incited insurrection against the government can get himself back in good graces with the establishment by tweeting one time that the debt is too high. And on the other side, the governor of Virginia had a blackface scandal and got punished by, check notes, remaining the governor of Virginia. So here we go. Maybe people like his policies. And Callow can ingratiate himself to this political reality by, why not, choosing the kidnapper as his running mate. I mean, the time to come together is now. Blah, 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 unity. And while we're at it, let's also just go ahead and nominate that pig for the Secretary of Agriculture. Because the fact is, in a time of divided government, he won't get through that confirmation process without getting roasted. Who's next? Oh.
Very nice. Sarah D. Bunting.
Oh, my God. Okay. Changing the meaning of the heel turn, my queens and yours, at the top of the ticket, NSA advisor to President Bartlett, Dr. Nancy McNally. In the sit room in her quilted bed jacket like a goddamn boss. That commitment to leisure wear during a crisis is what I need at the helm. Her vice president is someone who has held just about every position in government, usually not legally, but boy, can she rock a 5-inch pair of heels, Claire Underwood. So McNally Underwood 2024. it won't be boring. Tara.
Well, that's perfect setup. So my presidential candidate is going to be Senator Gil Evis, Democrat of Pennsylvania from Succession, played by Eric Bogosian. This is the very obvious Bernie Sanders stand-in, so it's a very obvious pick for yours truly. He is a widower. As far as we've seen so far, they're probably unlikely to be any bimbo eruptions. He is, unlike the real Bernie, smart enough to take a private jet when one is offered, even smarter enough to shit can Shiv Roy, despite her being the best in the Roy family at faking sincerity. He is sufficiently ruthless to maybe actually get elected, and his questioning of the Royco officers over their cruise ship scandals is a campaign ad in itself. And for his VP, Sarah, I went with Attorney General Mary Campbell from Madam Secretary, played by Anna DeVere Smith, who also like Nancy McNally. I prefer defense attorneys to prosecutors, but since former U.S. Attorney Liz Reddick from The Good Fight hasn't held office, she is my second choice. I also considered the dog who wins class president on Clone High for Gil's running mate, but I fear he would outshine Gil. Gil does not need that heat at the bottom of the ticket. Dave.
True.
My goal in politics in general at this point is just to get things to a livable point. You know, probably unsatisfying, but just like something we can all just exist with and then just run out the clock. Like that's like what I'm hoping for. I'm not like raising my expectations any higher than that. If that happens, like I can live with it. So with that in mind, and also let's go wind back time to remember like at the start of America's political system, it was sort of tradition for the presidential loser to become the VP. Like that happened quite a bit early on. So with those two things in mind, my presidential and vice presidential candidates are Jack Johnson and John Jackson from Futurama when they ran for president of Earth. Let's hear a little bit about their platforms.
It's time someone had the courage to stand up and say, I'm against those things that everybody hates. Now, I respect my opponent. I think he's a good man. But quite frankly, I agree with everything he just said.
These are the candidates? They sound like clones. Wait a minute. They are clones.
Don't let their identical DNA fool you. They differ on some key issues.
I say your 3-cent titanium tax goes too far. And I say your 3-cent titanium tax doesn't go too far enough.
That crazy backwards music can only mean one thing. It is time for a Nonak submission. The Nonak is the evil goatee twin of the canon. The worst a show has to offer is the kind of things we're talking about. So Dan Rogge, what do you have for us?
Well, guys, if the past year has afforded me one opportunity, it's that I have steeped myself thoroughly in the Riverdale cinematic universe and all associated properties. From the sometimes quite good and scary Sabrina, which is often better than it needs to be, until it's not, the not including a literal descent into hell storyline where hell is set decked like an executive underworld realness maxi challenge on the Drag Race main stage, my RCU journey took me next to the one season wonder Katie Keene, a show I will caution you against society's ritual disemboweling of Emily in Paris until you have engaged with the full season of this post-college New York fantasy, where the characters are so wildly uninteresting that after one season, even the CW was like, that's okay. All of which background lands you at the doorstep of the crown jewel of this universe, the elder teens' dark, twisted high school fantasy, Riverdale. Riverdale is a lot of shows in one. It's Twin Peaks for babies. It's Buffy the OC and Gossip Girl for 20-year-olds, written by 40-year-olds, spoken by 17-year-olds, being played by 29-year-olds. But at the best, the show is soapy, sometimes gritty, and really pretty spooky. And to quote my father-in-law, who repeatedly notes the cognitive disconnect inherent in the source material, as he comments in passing every single time he walks through the room while this show is on, this isn't how I remember the Archie comics, like literally every time the show has like 80 episodes. And like I said, Riverdale is a lot of shows. And season 4 of the series actually features some of my favorite darker storylines of the season. The gang gets wrapped up with some real psychos in an elite private school murder mystery is a personal favorite, while also featuring by far the worst storyline of the series, That would be character Cheryl Blossom digging up her dead twin brother and propping him up in a wheelchair while her long-suffering girlfriend Tony adds colorful dialogue like, "Wow, babe," and "Tell me more, babe," a sign of the often-mentioned lack of story for the show's characters of color, which is very real. But in addition to those highs and lows, it also features the worst single episode of the series, the one we are here to talk about today, and that is why I am submitting Season 4, Episode 17, Wicked Little Town, for entry into the dreaded Nonak. Now, your mileage may vary on how musical numbers and the overall gleification of the genre are integrated into these shows overall. From Veronica Lodge and her cheerleading troupe singing Jailhouse Rock to an incarcerated Archie Andrews in one episode, to Veronica Lodge, who you may have now been noticing is the show's resident Jenna Maroney, opening an illegal speakeasy underneath Pop's chocolate shop just so she can sing All That Jazz, yes, that actually happened, to back across the Riverdale universe, Sabrina Spellman singing nearly all of Masquerade from Phantom of the Opera at some kind of dinner party in hell. And when I say she sings nearly the entire song, it's like, not since Liza in Sex and the City 2 has there been such a painful feeling of, oh, okay, another verse, got it, another verse, we're not done yet, all good, got it. And while the episode in question is bad enough to stand on its own, it is worth mentioning that it aired immediately after the resolution of one of the season's biggest and best arcs, the aforementioned private school murder mystery. And the end of the previous episode puts a pretty closed-ended button on that story in a way that makes you feel like you've watched a pretty strong season finale. This gives you the distinct feeling that coming into this episode, the show had literally nowhere to go, so it decided to bench its A, B, C through G stories to sit back and luxuriate in the show's third musical episode, in which the key members of the cast are all planning to form in a variety show following season 2's Carrie and season 3's Heather's musical episode. Side note, it does strain credulity that the rest of the main characters would even appear in a variety show at all. Archie has spent the last two seasons, falling in and out of trouble, including escaping from juvie while being forced to participate in an underground all-teen illegal boxing ring. Like, if that kid went to your high school, take it from me, he's not in the musical. But unlike Carrie and Heather's niche and or cult shows, where it's basically fine if the lyrics are rewritten to speak to the lives of the characters in Riverdale, when the ambitious concept is applied to Hedwig and the Angry Inch, it takes the musical concept out of the silly and into the borderline offensive. Now, a word to the theater kid in all of us. Hedwig and the Angry Inch is queer canon. It is the singular vision of its creator, and while Hedwig the character has been played by many, many people, including straight actors, its context is key. I do not care how its lyrics can be applied to the inner struggle of Jughead Jones or his dad, Skeet Ulrich. Keep these lyrics out your mouth. Okay, fine. Let's talk about the episode itself. After an almost normal first 5 minutes, just kidding, the first 5 minutes is a montage of characters singing Wicked Little Town, but it's about Riverdale, including KJ Apa, Denso, I should stipulate the singing part. We'll talk more about the musical production in a second. We finally land on our resident gay character, Kevin Keller, who only gets called up from gay double A back to the Riverdale big leagues when it's time for some gay news, trying to convince the school's principal, Mr. Honey, that Hedwig is appropriate content for the school's variety show, as heard in clip one.
Here you go, Principal Honey. Another list of signups for the variety show.
Well, I've reviewed the acts submitted so far. They mostly seem fine, with one exception. Yours.
I'm sorry, but you won't be allowed to do a number from Hedwig and the Angry Inch. That show is... it's not appropriate for students and families.
It was on Broadway. There's a movie version of it.
An R-rated movie version. Look, why don't you do a number from a classic musical like Oklahoma or Carousel instead of some niche downtown cabaret show that would be more appropriate for pre-Nazi Berlin?
Hedwig is not a niche show. It celebrates identities, genders, expressions of all kinds, and it speaks to my entire generation. We are relentlessly slammed with crisis after crisis, and we take it, and we're numb, yes, but also screaming on the inside. Please just listen to us. We're people, not numbers. We're Generation Z.
Shut up, Kevin. The internal struggles. And the internal struggles whose voices this speech is meant to amplify are clearly Archie and Jughead and Benny. After Kevin ruins three scenes boo-hooing about the talent show and the fact that the principal is being mean for him, like, is this seriously the A story of the episode? Betty and the girls retire to her bedroom where they sing Wig in a Box and come up with a very bad idea in clip two.
Oh, my. Hey, Kev.
Yeah.
What if, for the variety show, we all performed songs from Hedwig?
Yeah. As a sign of solidarity.
And as president of the student body and Riverdale High's LGBTQIA Alliance, I promise you, I will sit down with Principal Humbug and make this right.
So if you can see past the actual cringiness of the singing itself, which again, we can get into more in a second, you can see deeper to notice that this is where the ritual straight washing of Hedwig begins. All good, Kevin the character has gotten trotted out of his gay coffin as a sop to appropriate representation, but besides the insanely low and trite stakes of this moment in comparison to a more typical one murder an episode pace of this show, this friendly notion that straight people co-opting the message of Hedwig will turn it into a more palatable version of itself is well-intentioned, but a little draining. It's like, after the commercials, Kevin will now be played by James Corden. Okay, not really, but... Okay. So after the cheerleaders sing Sugar Daddy in a Diner, and then something-something Veronica, we start to gauge the full extent to which this Hedwig virus has infected the rest of the cast in what tries to be a normal scene between Betty and Jughead, but then becomes clip three.
I'm sorry, in what future are we not together?
I'm going to New Haven in a few months, Jug. That is happening. Where are you going to
be? I thought I'd be your dorm husband just eating pizza while you studied criminal psych.
Yeah, well, I would rather that than this dead-end Jughead.
Oh, the Jughead that was brained with a rock? I'm sorry I'm different now. I guess death just changes a person.
But then turns in to clip four.
I guess death just changes a person.
Inside I'm hollowed out, outside the paper shroud, and all the rest's illusion. That there's a will and soul that we can wrest control from chaos and confusion. A collage! I'm all sewn up. A montage! I'm all sewn up.
How do you think I feel?
A random pattern with a needle and thread. The overlapping way diseases are spread to a tornado body with a hand grenade head. And the legs are two lovers entwined.
I was trying to do the right thing.
You weren't thinking, Archie.
Give me a break, Veronica. It's been a crappy year.
Oh God, I'm all sewn up. A hardened razor cut scum up across my body. And you can trace the lines through misery's design. The meth across my body.
Oof. Next time my entire presentation is actually just going to be me gesturing at Dave's current face. There is actually a...
Somebody take a screenshot.
There's actually a huge story moment around this point in the episode, and that is the kiss between Archie and Betty, who, yes, the internet actually refers to as Barchy. Ew. But to this theater kid, it is at this moment with Archie, Veronica, Betty, and Jughead screaming their feelings at one another in a song of thrashing catharsis that this version of the song is not acknowledging and cannot meet. I love you, Riverdale, but she don't have the range vocally or otherwise. And speaking of vocally, I have like a 20,000 word essay on the musical production of these shows itself and how the obvious shortcomings in their vocal abilities, shall we say, are papered over with the sonic perfection of the way that it's just strained through the computers in a sound that no way approximates the sound of live and or theater singing, but it's, I realized, like 5 a.m. and I can pick my battles on this episode, so let's keep moving. The Streets save the variety show by hosting it at the aforementioned Veronica-owned speakeasy. I'll let other scholars speak to the bigger picture plot holes inherent in a 17-year-old owning an illegal speakeasy in a society where alcohol is legal, but again, that's a tomorrow problem. And the newly formed band, the Archies, name-check themselves in Midnight Radio in a 45-minute end of Hey Jude cast sing-along, and by this point, even they, frankly, start to look very embarrassed. The final shots of the episode, in which we return to the season arc of mysterious videotapes being, return to the season arc of mysterious videotapes being submitted to the residents of Riverdale, and Jughead watches a masked version of Betty clock a masked version of himself with a rock that is genuinely good and terrifying, and reminds you that things will be back on tone in the next episode. This episode is silly and annoying on its own. It is 100 times more dissonant in the context of the more interesting episodes around it. It is the worst of a bad strain of Riverdale. It is playing far out of its depth and not trying particularly hard, or maybe too hard, while it's down there. And for that reason, I hope you will consider Riverdale Season 4, Episode 17, for inclusion in the no-neck. Tara.
Wow, Dan. I was mad at you last night, but I get it now. Thank you for this presentation. Like, I mean, I'm still a little bit mad today because we're a Katie Keene household, so
I know.
Like,
I'm so
just
sorry.
Watch what you say.
Yeah, fair.
I'm just kidding. I do love Katie Keene though. But this was an abomination, and you're so right that like it would be one thing if this were just a bad musical episode of Oklahoma, as Principal Honey suggests, but the fact that it's Hedwig is like really takes it to a whole other level of horror. Like, just for all, I mean, I can't improve on what you said, and the fact that so many of the people in it also, on top of that, can't sing. It's like just offensive in 50 different ways. I don't believe that the small town has this many wigs. I don't believe this is the small town has a magnolia, which is also referenced at some point. But on top of all that, like just the stakes of it. I mean, I have in my notes, like, are agents coming? Like, who cares if the school puts on the variety show, like right. Even as a frame for this event not going on. And that was before I knew, because I don't watch the show, that there was a speakeasy. So by the time that's the resolution, it's like, why don't you just do this in the first place? It's like, what were you fighting about? Who cares? It's all very dumb. This is a spectacular presentation about a true abortion of an episode. So thank you so much for bringing us this, I have to say, eminently, in my opinion, no-knock-worthy episode. Sarah.
This is no-knacky as fuck. I think one of Riverdale's strengths, and I'm not a regular watcher, but we do revisit it occasionally. And I do think that usually they are in way better control of the tone and the reference within the tone than this. I did really enjoy their tribute to Fred, Luke Perry.
Yeah.
That was nice.
And I thought that that was a place where it seemed like the show didn't tend to take itself too seriously, but then it was able to cash in some chits and be very serious at that time. I think it's trying to do this again, but it's like a little full of itself, like really feeling its shit in season 4. And it's like, this isn't, you're not as good as you think you are right now. It just doesn't match up tonally with the original show, which, like, I'm not familiar with it, but I'm familiar enough to know that this was a king that they should not have shot at because they missed. And like the songs, it's like there are rad songs in here, but I don't want to listen to this version of them.
Yeah.
And there were many scenes where I was like, just looking at it and being like, what did this cost to do and for what? Like the I am Hedwigicus moment where everybody's in costume in the hallway for like 8 seconds. And I'm like, guys, what is that for? I can't like every, all my other notes are like, you know, this is painful. This feels very forced, blah, blah, blah. Like what, why get into it? Talk about 20,000 words. But before I throw to Dave, I will close on this note, which this is what turned me on the episode. And it was like the, it was the first clip we heard. Is that Principal Honey is played by fucking Kerr Smith, saying that Hedwig is not appropriate for high school students. If you think that I have forgotten that he was quoted in fucking Entertainment Weekly being like, I don't think kids need to see that kind of lifestyle. I haven't. Just like I'm going to keep bringing up Nicole Malliotakis photoshopping herself into a Mutual Aid Society photo, I'm going to keep bringing that up too. I don't think the show understands the reference. P.S. If you want to hear a Jersey accent, that's what you're hearing right now because I'm fucking pissed off. Dave.
Yeah, speaking about him as Principal Honey, boy, he is trying and failing to do his best Victor Garber in that role.
Oh, isn't yeah.
He?
Like
that yeah. Should have been Victor yeah, Garber is. For sure.
Oh, God, yeah.
What was the show recently where somebody was singing and it was so obvious that it wasn't them?
It was when we were watching that. Dear Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Dear Christmas. Yeah. We were watching Dear Christmas, the Jason Priestley Lifetime movie. And he, one of his talents is so singing. Sad. And that guy is 50. And obviously a 18 to 22 year old is singing his parts. Right. That is bad. But if you can get somebody who kind of feels like they're going to sound like that character, use them if your actor can't sing. Like, take the time, find somebody who can sing that kind of feels like a tonal match to what you expect, like, you know, whoever to sound like. That's fine. You don't have to have the actors sing if they can't, and give yourself permission to do a good job finding, you know, a substitute. Pre-Nazi Germany is the Weimar. You can say that. It's okay. Give your, you know, audience a little bit of credit, or say both, you know, slip it in there, I guess. That annoyed me.
They have Google. And it's fine.
I really got nothing to add beyond the one moment in this episode that kind of was the poster child to the care they took was during one scene where they do their song and Principal Honey's all mad. He goes to the amp and he unplugs the amp after the song is done. He waits until after, which, ooh. And after the song is done, he yanks the cord out of the wall and then the singer drops the mic. And it does the powered squeal thing, which was not going to happen if you don't have power to the mic. So that kind of care is exactly emblematic of this whole episode. It was it was an abomination. It was bad. And the Jughead one.
Oh, God.
Especially where he starts screaming, singing. It was just like, oh, no. Like I was like watching it through tented fingers for sure.
Yeah.
All right, let's put this the official vote. Tara Ariano, what say you?
Well, as Dan said, by the end of it, everyone involved really looks embarrassed, which they do and they should. So it's a yes for the no nag for me.
Sarah?
This corpse is not exquisite. It's horrible. Fuck you some more, Kerr Smith. Last one. And this is a yes for the no nag from me.
Agreed. That means Riverdale, Season 4, Episode 17, Wicked Little Town. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great No-Nag.
Americans love a winner. And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time to find out who our winner and loser of the week is. Sarah has the winner.
Oh, I do. And I'm sure there's a fun segue for this, but I can't reach it right now because I'm weak with laughter. Oh, there it is. The Weakest Link is our winner. It has been renewed for season two at NBC. I am thrilled. I think that's a really good format. I'm glad it's back, and I'm glad it's going to continue to be on.
And Loser of the Week?
Well, having an episode of her show get voted into the NONAC was not the worst thing to happen to Lily Reinhart this week. Apparently, someone posing as her has been doing interviews with a bunch of different media outlets and getting them published and not even like saying anything wild or crazy or inappropriate. They're just like pretending to be her boring self for sport. Wow. So, yeah, 17 was one of the places that published an interview with her and then had to take it down and be like, sorry, that was totally not her. Whoopsies.
Wow.
This is what happens when you do interviews with people over email, I guess, and why you should not do that.
Hey, speaking about pretending to be your boring self for sport, do you know what time it is?
Wow, it's game time.
Hey.
Welcome back to Game Time. This is the seventh Game Time of the season. Scores are tied. Everybody has 2 points. How exciting. Today we are playing Double Vision from Dan Casino, who earns himself an extra credit topic. He writes, with the movies being a lost cause, we've all been spending a lot more time watching TV over this past year. But some of the shows that debuted in 2019 or 2020 could stand to be spiced up a little bit. To that end, Dan has taken TV shows that premiered in 2020 and one, I think, in 2019 and mashed them up in 2 different ways. First, we have a set of before and after type questions in which I will give you a description of a mashed up show by combining 2 shows at the beginning or ends of the titles. We've all done that before. Mm-hmm. One of them is a 2020 show. Okay. Then we have infix style mashups at the end of the game. And that's where one show is stuck in the middle of a title of another show, turducken style.
Okay.
Got it.
Turducken style.
For any of the questions, you can ask for a hint, which will be 1 actor from each of the shows. And then 2 points without the hint, 1 point with the hint. Note that, as always, articles and plurals can be dropped for a better fit. There are 24 before and afters, 15 infixes, plus a tiebreaker. Tara Arena, okay. Can I get the steel meal situation, please?
Yes, sir. Sarah DeBunting has 8 steel meals. I also have 8 steel meals. Dan, I regret to tell you, Caroline cleaned out the valued guest steel meals last week, but you have 1.
And at this point, we do want to do some lexicon house cleaning. Just to be sure, Nick Reinwell Jonesing is when you use all the steel meals and still lose.
Okay.
Framkeying is when you do the same and win.
And win.
So you don't want a Nick Reinwell Jones it. You definitely want to Framkey the situation.
She Framkeyed.
Yeah, always.
All right. Let's start the picket to see who will be going first.
We will start with Sarah.
All right. Sarah, Tara, Dan is our order today. Are we ready to play 2020 Double Vision?
Yes.
Let's do it.
Sarah, a high school audiophile from Toronto dissects her love life to find out what went wrong with her relationships.
From Toronto.
One of these shows was a 2020 show.
Wrong with her relationships. I need a hint, please.
We're talking about Drake and Zoe Kravitz.
Degrassi High Fidelity.
That is correct for 1 point. Tara.
Yep.
Anthology series based on a New York Times column in which insufferable English majors recount their run-ins with Cthulhu.
Oh, modern Lovecraft Country.
Good for wow. 2.
Nicely done.
Dan, here comes your first. A poetically horny, anachronistic, and period piece about a violent, drug-running biker gang.
All right. I'll take the hint.
Haley Steinfeld and Katie Sagal.
Katie, I know. Oh, what is it? Sons of... Can't... I don't know. It's...
Anybody?
Deal meal.
That is Dickinson's of Anarchy.
Right. There you go.
Back to Sarah. A family of cops discovered that their mustachio patriarch is really a Greek god.
Is really a Greek god? I mean, I don't know what the Greek god one is. I think the first one's Blue Bloods. Can I have the hint, please?
Tom Selleck and Jason O'Mara.
Fuck. I don't know. I know it's Blue Bloods, but I don't know the other half.
It is Blue Bloods. It's Blue Bloods of Zeus. Remember?
Never heard of that joke. No.
Yeah.
Hey, look. 2020 shows. Some are going to hit, some are not. How hard have you been paying attention? Tara.
Not, apparently. Yeah.
An evil British firm hires a naive American in an attempt to hurt their own stock price, but he winds up winning everyone over.
Okay. It's Ted Lasso is one. I thought the other one was industry, but they do not click together. Hint, please.
Portia de Rossi and Jason Sudeikis.
No. Better off Ted Lasso.
Wow, there you go.
Correct. To Dan. An international superstar takes up with both a bread maker and a lion man from an underground civilization.
I don't...
Takes up with both a bread maker and a lion man from an underground civilization. So if you know one part, you might be able to connect it to the other part.
From an underground civilization. I will take the hint.
We're talking Victor Razzik and Linda Hamilton. The first one is a show I think maybe only Tara watched.
Literally. In the world.
All right. The Linda Hamilton is Beauty and the Beast with her lion man. And that is The Baker and the Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, there you go. Wow. Oh. Yeah, we could have been here all month.
Sarah D. Bunting. An animated series about can-do local government officials and their musical attempts to save a major urban green space.
Hint.
Audrey Plaza and David Diggs.
Oh.
Yeah, I got nothing. Sorry.
Anybody?
Nope.
Central Parks and Recreation.
Right.
Sure.
It was on Central Park. Yep.
Batman's daughter gets caught up with John Brown's doomed assault on Harper's Ferry.
The good Lord Birds of Prey.
That is great. Whoa.
Nice.
Damn. Game show in which you win by knowing the manufacturer's suggested retail price of an Atlas rocket.
It's the manufacturer, that's the price is right. Okay, well, I'll take the second half of that hint.
Drew Carey.
Sure.
And Patrick J. Adams.
What is this show? Do you guys know it?
I do. I have the answers.
All right.
No idea?
Yeah, no.
Anybody else?
Steel Meal.
Steel Meal from Sarah.
The Price is Right Stuff.
The Price is Right Stuff. Right Stuff TV series, correct. Or miniseries. Sarah. An alternate history in which Charles Lindbergh wins the presidency to Tyra Banks and the girls are not safe.
Alternate history. Hint.
Jay Alexander and Winona Ryder. I don't remember her in that show at all. I think we watched half an episode. Any idea?
I mean, no. America's Next Top Stranger Things? Like, I don't know. I don't know.
Anybody know that one?
The Plot Against America's Next Top Model.
The Plot Against America's Next Top Model is great.
Pot leader.
Tara.
Yes.
Kim Cattrall plots to get a fortune from the world's most despicable boy millionaire.
Filthy Richie Rich.
It's good for two. Whoa. Taking us into our first score break for Dan. Long-running BBC series about members of the Home Guard chosen to parent their friend's kid after his death.
Okay. Hit.
Clive Standen and noted British character actor John Laurie.
I
this is a tough one.
Do you guys? I just don't know.
This is definitely a Dan Casino question.
I was going to say.
Council of Dad's Army.
No.
Right, Council of Dads.
All right, that takes us into our first score break. 2020 shows are the Achilles heels, apparently, for our panel. Well, let's hear the scores.
Yeah, not all of us.
This is a challenging one. I have 7, Sarah has 2, Dan looking to get on the board.
Because what have I been doing besides consuming content in 2020?
All right, let's get back to it. Sarah D. Bunting. Rob Lowe and his team try to contain the ridiculous damage done by the newly empowered daughter of a superhero.
The newly empowered daughter of a superhero? This isn't really going to help, but hint.
First of all, this is a great name. Ronan Rubinstein and Amy Smart.
Amy Smart is working? That's nice. 911 Lone Star Man. I don't know.
We were close. 911 Lone Star Girl from the CW. One of the 10,000 comic book shows on the CW.
Yeah.
Tara.
Yep.
RuPaul and an orphan chess genius travel the byroads of America.
Oh, God. Okay. AJ and the Queen's Gambit.
There you go.
Correct.
Nice.
Dan. Sketch comedy show set in a New England house inhabited by spirits and magic portals.
Sketch comedy show. The sketch comedy show. Saturday Night Live Manor.
That one is Lock and Key and Peel.
Oh, good.
Oh, okay.
Sarah.
Yep.
Fred Armisen and John C. Reilly are among the long-haired magical girls trying to get into the space program. Remember that show, Tara?
I know we watched like half of the season and I don't remember what it's called.
Can I hear the hint or not the hint? Can I hear the clue again, please? Yeah.
Fred Armisen and John C. Reilly are among the long-haired magical girls trying to get into the space program.
Now I need the hint.
Tim Heidecker, and for the U.S. dub, the voice of Susan Roman. So there's a hint.
Not enough. Sorry, I don't know this one.
Anybody?
It's Sailor Moon, but I forget what that Showtime show was called.
Sailor Moon Base 8. Yeah.
I was like, Moon Base Earth, but I knew that wasn't right.
I was like stuck on For All Mankind and just it wasn't happening.
This is question 17.
It's pretty cool.
It is for Tara.
Mm-hmm.
Spin-off sequel series about a drug kingpin's son who can see dead people.
Hint.
Mary J. Blige and Jennifer Love Hewitt.
Nope.
That, of course, is Book Power 2, Ghost Whisperer.
Whoa.
Oh, okay.
All right, Dan. Something is really off in Arlen, Texas's new Big Cat Park.
Oh. All right, I'll take the hint.
Joe Exotic and the voice of Steven Root.
Tiger King of the Hill.
Tiger King of the Hill, good for one.
Yay!
This is question. For Sarah. Steve Carell's first mission to the stars goes awry and he gets stuck a long way from home with the Robinsons and their robot.
Lost in Space Force?
Hey.
Nice.
Tara.
Yep.
Televised version of a podcast about Richard Nixon and his ties to former spies and fixers in Miami.
Hint.
Bruce Campbell and archival footage of G. Gordon Liddy.
Bruce Campbell. Oh, Slow Burn Notice.
Slow Burn Notice, correct.
I was thinking it was Fiasco. That's way off. Okay.
Oh, I like this one. All right. For Dan. A twee romance between a literary girl in New York and a gangster in Norway.
And a gangster in Norway.
Any idea there?
I know the first one.
That's what is it, the first one? Just talk it out.
I know. It's the one with the thing. I watched the whole thing. Like, I'll just, because I don't, but I don't know the second half anyway. Hint.
Midori Francis and Steven Van Zandt.
Oh, oh God. Who's going to steal it? I don't know. Oh,
Dan doesn't know. Anybody?
Dash and Lillehammer.
Dash and Lillehammer is correct. All right. It is now time to switch over to infixes. So these will be one title inside of another. If you thought it was hard before, get ready.
Oh, cool.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Yes.
A dancing talk show host's primetime series has her hunting down humans for sport.
Has her hunting down humans for sport?
Yes.
I need a hint.
Announcer Stephen Boss and Christoph Waltz.
Dancing with the Circus of the Stars. I don't know.
Steal meal.
Steal from Dan.
Is it Ellen's Most Dangerous Game of Games?
It is.
Wow. Nice.
Nice.
Tara.
Yes.
A former FBI director botches a critical investigation and as punishment has to travel around in an RV with Johnny Bananas.
I mean, I know. Okay, I don't understand. I need okay hint.
Holly Hunter and Adam Larson.
Holly Hunter?
Talk it out. What
okay.
do you know?
Well, the Johnny Bananas, that's the challenge. But I don't know what shows that she was in. It's not Top of the Lake. It's not The Mayor. It's not Succession. So I don't know what it is, what her Holly Hunter show is.
Anybody else want to take a stab at that? Also, Road Rules would have counted for Johnny Bananas. It's the Comey Road Rule.
I forgot she was in that.
Oh, my God.
Damn.
Casino.
A Midwestern transplant looks for an organ donor in New York, but is warned about Kristen Ritter.
Kristen Ritter. Is that Don't Trust the Bee? She. Okay, so I'll take the hint for the first one.
James Vanderbeek and Thomas Middleditch.
Oh, wait. Okay. I don't know.
Don't trust the B positive in apartment 23.
Don't trust the B positive in apartment 23. Sarah. A trucker slash human trafficker makes a critical mistake when he takes a polygamous Mormon's third wife.
Hint.
Chloe Sevigny and Dee Dee Pfeiffer.
Yeah, I got nothing. I mean, I know one of them's Big Love, but...
Big Sky Love.
Oh, Sky Love. Oh, good for Dee Dee Pfeiffer.
Tara.
Yep.
After witnessing and maybe committing a murder in New Zealand, two musical comedians try to figure out what really happened.
Hint.
Kaylee Cuoco and Jermaine Clement.
The flight attendant of the Concords.
That's good for a point.
Nice.
Dan. Deciding that even death should end this celebrity reality show, E follows a vapid clan into a virtual reality afterlife.
Reality vapid clan. I feel like... Q
keeping up with. And then what's the.
Call you on that one. That is keeping upload with the Kardashians.
Oh, right. That's it.
Yeah.
Disney Plus revival in which Miss Piggy makes fun of classic nonfiction films.
Classic nonfiction films. Okay. Documentary Muppets Now.
Good for two. Hey!
Nice.
Yikes.
Tara.
Yep.
Extraterrestrial refugees come to Earth, and Padma Lakshmi is going to experience their food and culture firsthand.
Okay. It's Taste the Nation. What's the other show? I don't know. I don't know the other show, so it's not going to get me anywhere. So,
do you want the hint, or are you just going to that? You're
no, sure. Give me the hint.
Mandy Patinkin and Preet Bharara.
No. No, I don't know what the Mandy Patinkin show is.
That's Taste the Alien Nation.
Ew. No. No,
don't
thank you.
Don't. Yeah.
All right, we're getting towards the end of the show. This one's for Dan. We'll take us into our second score break. Huxley adaptation in which strangers have to live together, but they take drugs to ensure there's no actual drama.
The Brave New Real World?
Correct.
Nice.
2 points. And that'll take us into our score break. Tara, can I get the scores, please?
You can. I have 11. Sarah has 6. Dan has 4.
All right. Let's get back to it. 2 questions left for everybody, starting with Sarah D. Bunting. Mrs. Garrett mentors an exonerated felon turned lawyer.
Exonerated felon turned lawyer. God. I would ask for a hint, but it won't help. The Facts of Afterlife?
Very close. The Facts for Life. For Life.
Oh, For Life. Yeah. That's what that...
Tara.
Yeah.
What's called?
Reese Witherspoon's life is disrupted when she rents a house to a Dickensian waif raised in a debtor's prison.
Little Dorrit fires everywhere?
Little Dorrit fires everywhere. Correct.
Would you also have accepted Big Little Dorrit Lies?
I don't know.
That's not what happens in Big Little Lies, is it? Does she have a house that she rents?
No, but it's just interesting that you could cram Little Dorrit into both of those.
All right, Dan. Sarah Wainwright series about a cop searching for the man who assaulted her teenage daughter at a Mississippi strip club.
No. Oh, I shouldn't even bother with a hint, but why not? Drag it out.
All right. According to Dan, we've got James and then in quote, Grant Chester Norton and Brandy Evans.
I don't know.
Anybody?
I know one half, but...
What is?
P Valley, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's P Happy Valley, isn't
P
it?
P Happy Valley, correct.
Oh.
Sarah D. Bunting, last question coming at you. Short-lived Marvel series in which the son of Satan calls people idiot sandwiches before exercising them. A short-lived Marvel series in which the son of Satan calls people idiot sandwiches before exercising them.
Hell's Kitchen Boy?
Hellstrom's Kitchen, Hell's Kitchen Strum. That's Hell's Kitchen.
Okay, Hellstrom. Hellstrom. All right.
Tara.
Damn you, Casino.
The backstory of a villainous talking horse training to be a nurse.
Hint?
Sarah Paulson and Alan Lane.
Oh, my God. Mr. Ratched.
Mr. Ratched. At one point.
Good God.
It was like Nurse Bojackie Horseman.
Cino.
All right, last question for Dan. Tween New York-based karaoke and maybe singing competition in which all the songs are written by Sarah Bareilles.
All the songs written tween singing competition, which is what... And then all the songs written by Sarah Bareilles is, but Waitress isn't on TV. Okay, one more time with the hint.
Host Ken Jeong and Brittany O'Grady.
Oh yeah, what was that terrible show that he hosted? Let's hear Dave say it.
Anybody know that one? Tara?
I can see your little voice.
I can see your little voice.
Nice. Oh, correct. I was like, little the voice?
That's what I was thinking too before Ken Jeong.
All right, that was a high difficulty game. Let's hear the regulation final scores, please.
Ooh. Okay, Dan finished with 4. Sarah had 6. I had 14.
Nice.
Very lucky picky picks.
Well done, Tara.
Let's play the tiebreaker for an extra stew meal for future use. Anybody shout out the answer when they think they know it. Will Arnett hosts this reality competition in which pioneering scientists use building blocks to measure orgasms.
Lego Masters of Sex.
Lego Masters of Sex is correct. Tarkus is steel wheel.
Dan Cassino, you're a bad, bad man.
Tara.
Good job, Tara.
Me.
Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We took the bridge and tunnel to Epic's new dramedy before going around the dial with stops at Perfect Life, Walker, America's Next Top Model, Everwood, and 911 Lone Star. Dan's choice for the no-nat convinced us all to...
Stay out of Riverdale.
We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Mr. Dan Cassino. Next up, completing the EOT from Extra Extra Hot Great, and on the next EHG Prime, Firefly Lane. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
seriously here for your Jared Padalecki hair theories.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Damn you, Burns Lanty.
And Dan Rogie.
Ed Burned.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Now I know how Sisyphus must have felt.
Ah!